Radio. This is Pet Life Radio. Let's talk pets.
Yes, everybody! You know the drill. We've started this podcast to help anyone who is remotely interested in trapping and neutering animals. We're the help we did not receive when we first wanted to get involved, and we want to be your new besties in the TNR world. I'm Alex, one of your hosts for this ride, and I'm so grateful to have Adele by my side. Hi, Adele!
Hello, Alex. Are you ready for another week of talking about pigeons?
Yay! Love this pigeon talk.
So, as we spoke about last time, we normally talk about spay and neuter, and we usually talk about felines. But we also care about all different species of animals and how we can help them. So in a previous episode, we had a fellow pigeon rescuer come on and talk about different types of reproductive care for pigeons and caring for pigeons in general. And this week, we're going to talk to Sue, who lives in Wales and is the founder of Little Green Pigeon. So Sue has a background of working in pigeon sanctuary for many years and went through a transition period in recent history of transitioning the sanctuary and rehoming the birds to other avian sanctuaries and focusing completely on creating a support network for other pigeon rescuers in the UK. And it's really cool to see because you made quite an intentional transition with this, you know, like you took the time to make sure all the pigeons had new homes, and it was a rare insight into transitioning out of sanctuary in the right way that we normally don't get to see. So that's quite cool. You have a lot of things you're working on, right? So you have the charity shop that you work in most days, and that supports your work to support sanctuaries. You do campaigns around banning pigeon racing. And later this year, you're going to have, is it the world's first pigeon advocacy conference in the UK?
Yeah, hi. Thank you so much for having me on for that lovely introduction. It is the world's first advocacy pigeon conference. Yeah, so it's exciting.
That's awesome.
Really, really exciting. Yeah.
We're so happy to have you on, Sue. Thank you so much for joining us. It's going to be a very interesting conversation. But as usual, we like to gently start the conversation. And the question is, when did you first become vegan and why?
Right. Well, yeah. I mean, that's the question we all want to know when we meet a new vegan, isn't it? So I have been vegetarian, like a lot of us were, since the age of 8. And that was because I was, I don't even know where I was, but out somewhere in the UK and came across a leaflet from the International Fund for Animal Welfare about animal testing. And that day decided that was it. That was what my life's purpose was going to be, was to try and get this stopped and do that kind of thing. When you're 8 year old, you know, you have these ideas, don't you? But I kind of haven't really changed. But what I did was I became vegetarian overnight, much to my parents' horror. And I kept that up until I was in my mid-30s. And I'd had a child by then who basically did exactly the same. So they'd been raised vegetarian all their life. They came home from school one day and just said, "Mum, we are not doing enough. We need to be vegan."
Oh my God.
And I remember going, "No, we don't. We're fine. We're doing enough. It's fine. Dairy cows are happy. And, you know, the eggs, the chickens that lay the eggs, they're fine. We buy free range," all the things that everybody says. And he showed me a video and I just went, "Oh." And I remember getting up, going to the fridge, tipping the milk down the sink, and that was it. We were vegan overnight. It was about 15 years ago. So that's my journey. It was like two snaps. So it was a snap. I was vegetarian, 30 years of ignorance, and then a snap and I was vegan. And like so many people that are vegan, it's the best thing I've ever done. And it's changed my life.
I really love that it was from your kid. Like, it was full circle.
Yeah.
Like the new generation.
I'm really proud of him. Yeah.
Being like, "Hey, no, I'm not doing enough. Wow, what a cool kid."
Yeah, he's great. Yeah.
So can you mention, because right before we start recording, you mentioned you have a podcast yourself. So tell us a bit about that.
I do. So when last year, when like Adele said, I was making plans to close the sanctuary, and that's for a lot of different reasons. And it's a bit of a story. Anyone who follows me online will have been with us for the 3 years. It's been quite a 3 year story, but the decision was made. And my friend Jim, who's run Bloody Vegans podcast for about the last 3 years himself, he's a podcast editor. he got in touch and said, look, I know there are some changes and you're not ready yet, but I would love you to host my podcast. I've done it for years. And I just think, you know, we could do with a bit of a shake up and you'd be a good host. So I was very flattered. Know nothing about really about that kind of technology. So it's been a steep learning curve. But yeah, so I took over in December. I'm loving it. I've had some really good guests. Really, really enjoyed it. Yeah, it's been really good fun. I've got lots of good guests to record with this month as well. So yeah, so hopefully I'll be a good guest for you. Otherwise, something's going really wrong because I should know what I'm doing.
No, you're great.
But yeah, Bloody Vegan is great fun.
No, you're great, Susan. And you have so many interesting things to share. I think like your background in sanctuary is quite an interesting, and the process that you went through to transition to something new is really, really interesting. And I think it ties in quite well with like what we talk about here. The reason why we got into spay neuter for cats is to basically prevent this overwhelming need for rescue and wanting to help, but never being able to rescue everybody, right? So it's just the same with other species, right? Like so much to the point where, you know, you had a pigeon specific sanctuary and you ended up with all these animals and there's so many challenges to keeping them in shelter spaces. So that's quite interesting and cool. What inspired you to start working with pigeons originally?
I worked in veterinary practice and I did that for quite a long time. And I've done other things as well. I had a dog daycare center. I was the first in the UK to have one of those. And then I broke my back and I had to go back into veterinary practice. But whereas all the years before as an RVN, I was doing anesthesia and I was at the back of the practice, this time because I got a bad back and I couldn't work with the animals anymore, I was at the front. I had a clinic. I had my own consulting room and clinic at the front. So I was near reception and I could see what was going on. And it was the first time that I'd really understood the amount of clients that were bringing in birds for care and being turned away. Now, this was a city practice in England near Birmingham, a big hospital, and I was just horrified. And I had my eyes open completely. I had no idea that many birds needed help. And so I sort of said, well, we've got to change something. Went and spoke to the practice manager and said, look, if I learn a little bit about this, could I look after these birds and I'll take them home and I'll look after them at home and release them at home? And they were like, yeah, okay, as long as it doesn't affect your job. And so I did that for about 8 years. So I was working there and then literally that was what was happening in the back of the practice in the kennel room. There was a kennel specifically for all the different birds. I mean, not the best ethics because no matter what bird they were, apart from bird of prey, I didn't look after them. They were all just in one kennel and they just had to kind of get on with it because that was the best I could do. And I just had to learn on the job. But I didn't really look after pigeons because there was a nurse at the practice that was looking after pigeons for me. So I didn't have to look after them. And then she left. So I started looking after pigeons. And again, it was like another revelation. It was like, oh my goodness me, they are so complicated and so different to little garden birds. And everybody hates them. And I love an underdog. So I think it was just then I decided, right, that's it now. That's sort of, you could kind of see now looking back, I'm like, right, I can see all these things that happened and it just led me to where I am now. And it's those decisions you made, you know, you have to make. And it was that, it was like, well, hang on a minute. People hate them. Loads of them are being brought in. And actually, and this still happens today in a lot of practices, the first thing that will happen when a pigeon gets brought into a practice is they get euthanized.
Yeah.
Because people don't want to spend the time to see what's wrong with them and how they can help them. And because people are scared of them, which is ridiculous because they're really gentle birds. But because they're not pretty like a garden bird in the UK, they're not pretty like a goldfinch or, you know, or a blue tit, because they're big grey birds, people just sort of, they're classed as other than and they're just left and, you know, it's not on. So I just decided then and there to change that. So that carried on then for about another 3 years. And I just became overwhelmed. The RSPB got hold of my telephone number is what happened. And I was getting 60 or 70 calls a week to help nationally with pigeons. It just went absolutely insane. So obviously I couldn't do that. It was just me. I was very lucky that at the time I lived in a property that was rented, but my landlord was great. And I had a really, really big garden and I was able to get some funding from a family member and we bought some aviaries. And it just kind of snowballed and it really got out of control. And I ended up with quite quickly about 400 birds. 50 of which were disabled, about 100 of which were releasable. But the difference with a garden bird to a pigeon is you try and, if you've raised a baby pigeon that's been brought in injured and you try and release them, a feral, that is, they'll just stay where they are. They won't fly away because they're non-migratory birds. So they'll stay where their family is. They'll stay where the food is. So when you start releasing these birds, they're just going to stay. So it very quickly escalated to 400 birds. I had more than that at one point. Yeah, it was crazy. But I loved it. It was amazing.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, and I think that's a really interesting point and connects really well to why we want to talk about pigeons, because just like dogs and cats, like pigeons are not wild species anymore. They're domesticated, right? And that's one of the campaigns you work on, is where they come from, and they live in the environment with us, and you can't quite treat them like wild species. The wild species centers won't necessarily take them, but also a lot of vet clinics, they won't treat them, right? They don't view them as patients. So can you tell us a little bit about that? Like, people bring them into vet clinics, and are there laws around they have to be euthanized, or is it just a lack of interest in helping the pigeons?
Pigeons are a bit of a strange species, as you rightly said, because when they're out on the street, the feral pigeons are technically wild birds, but they come from a domestic background. So the only reason in the UK that there are pigeons on the streets and all over the world, it's not just the UK, but is because thousands of years ago, we bred them for meat and eggs, and then we abandoned them. And that's why they've ended up on the streets. And because they're survivors, they breed really well. They're really good parents. They generally mate for life. So they have plenty of broods each year, plenty of young. So they're just really good at reproducing. And actually, even when the food isn't plentiful, they, unlike other birds, they will still keep producing young. So they just breed and breed and breed. So numbers can grow very, very quickly in a town population. And as I say, the reason that they're in the town is because they're looking for people for help, because they are domestic birds and there is no food for feral pigeons in this country. So they can eat certain types of grass and seed and clover and those kind of thing. But actually in the UK, there is no natural food for a feral pigeon. So that's why they're coming into places where there are shops selling food, so they can eat basically bread-based food, because that's what they know, they're grainivores. So that's why they end up there. And the problem comes that then, because they're good at finding food from people, and because they are finding the wrong food, even though it's calorific, it's not the right food, they end up very poorly. They end up with diarrhea. They end up with salmonella. They end up with all sorts of horrible diseases and worms, and nobody cares about them. So they just get kicked. They get injured. They have a terrible time on our streets. And also because of that, the councils won't invest any money into contraception or into getting them out of the cities. So the law is a bit of a strange one, because they are domestic, but because they're out on the streets, they're classed as wild. So the RSPCA won't do anything about them, whether they're in practice in someone's home or out on the street, because they're not domestic. And the wild side of the RSPCA don't want to touch them either, because they say, well, they are wild, but they're actually a little bit domestic. So again, we don't really know what we need to do with them. So you just can't get a straight answer, you know, and that sounds like a really convoluted answer from me. And that's because there isn't an answer for it. Nobody will take responsibility for these birds at all. Nobody wants to. I actually think there are some fairly easy things that as a country we could do, and as a world we could do, because this is not a condition, an animal issue just in the UK, it's all over the world. There are things that we could easily do, and they're just not done because they cost time and money, but actually because they cost the investment of people looking. If you walk down the street and somebody sees an injured rabbit or if you're in the country, or they see an injured goldfinch or a blackbird, you can guarantee 10 people will rush, or a hedgehog, they'll rush to pick them up and find them, you know, some help. People just see an injured pigeon or a pigeon that's not looking very well and completely dismiss them. So there's just no love for them. And people now get fined for feeding them. It's a whole mess. The whole thing's a mess.
Can you talk about that a little bit? What some solutions you think might be? You mentioned contraception. Like, what are some practices you know about that actually help manage their rate of reproduction, but also address their well-being?
In sanctuary, the way we control their reproduction is to take their eggs away. Now, technically, that's illegal. So if there were a pigeon outside in a tree outside my window now, and I went and took the eggs away, I would be breaking the law. They are covered by the wildlife laws in this country to that point. But
what?
Yeah. But if that same bird was injured and I took that same parent
bird or that baby
into practice, to a veterinary practice, they have no legal obligation to look after that bird, and they could euthanize without thinking about it at all. So they're really, really difficult. But what they're trialing now in Germany, which I think is incredible, and it's incredible, but is it ethical? And these are always the problems that we face, aren't they? They are trialing a food that has a contraception in them. It's a big enough seed that really only pigeons will eat it. So the wild birds won't eat it. So it won't cause those birds any problem. And any other animal would either, like a rat, would either not be interested, or they would have to eat so much of it that it wouldn't really affect them. You know, if like your local dog was going around and snuffling up grain, for example, you know, a stray dog, they would have to eat so much of it. They don't think it would cause a problem. And the idea with that is just to try and give some contraception to the female birds, just to try and stop them breeding so we can control their population. There's a couple of downsides. The one is you've then got people going out and giving seed, and you've got to make sure they're exclusively getting those seeds, which is very, very hard to do. And the second problem is it only works at the moment, the contraception on that seed only works for about 8 days. So you have to constantly top up the food, and it's very, very, very expensive. So you've got to have a local council that has got somebody that can do that or will take responsibility for that, and B, that will put money behind it. And certainly in the UK, you can't get anyone to put money behind pigeons, even when you can say to them, look, you've got shopkeepers that are moaning about the feces down the front of the building. Instead of having that, we could take the pigeons up, we could encourage them away from the town centre into the countryside, and we could feed them there and use contraception. The councils are just really short-sighted, and they'll just sort of say, oh, but it's easier just to put spikes or netting up, which is ineffective. It doesn't help. It just injures birds. There's the contraception with pigeons. We're making waves. There are little things being trialled, and they're having success in Germany. But I kind of just get the impression that Germany's got a more forward-thinking council and government than we have. So I think it'll be a long time before we get that here, but it's worth a try.
Yeah, and just to add to that, this was a little bit of the conversation we had last time, that this is one of the things that governments are implementing. Also, feeding bans is something you mentioned before, which obviously doesn't do anything for their well-being. Yeah. But we spoke also about egg replacement projects. So this is something that they're doing all across Germany as well, which the groups actually advocate for, instead of just putting medication in the seed, which doesn't really address the well-being and has some of the other problems you've mentioned. So it's much more about preventing the reproduction. And they do thousands and thousands of egg replacements across the country. And this seems to be something that they're much more excited about. Do you know anything about projects like that, or have any thoughts on that?
No, as far as I'm aware, there are none of those in this country. And that is, it's for the same reason. It's that what you, looking at the model in Germany, what you'd need is you need people that are responsible for doing that, and kind of an area where you would be allowed to encourage the birds to go to do that. Because doing that around the towns here, you'd have people on ladders trying to get up buildings, and it would just be an absolute nightmare. But there are also so many abandoned and unlooked after, I don't know if that's the right word, but not looked after buildings in this country, where pigeons are going into the roofs where the tiles are broken and they're nesting inside there. I mean, you've got no access to buildings like that. And there are thousands of places like that where they're roosting. So you'd just not be able to competently replace all the eggs. The other way they try and do it in this country, and I know that's happening in a few places, which is extremely sad, is they're bringing hawks in to deter the birds. But the reality of that is it doesn't work, because the birds just go slightly further out, and they still come back into feed, and then they just go somewhere else to roost. It doesn't work. But I think they just want to put a band-aid over a cut. They don't actually want to address the real problem. They just, oh, look, we've done that now, just to keep people happy. Oh, yeah, that's that solved. And they don't understand the way these birds work either. And one of the things I'm working on, as you've mentioned, is trying to get pigeon racing banned as well. Now, that's a whole other subject, and it's incredibly cruel blood sport. But part of the reason I want that ban as well is because they do add to the numbers of pigeons on the streets weekly. If you've got a big race going over from, say, from Wales to Ireland, we know just in the little tiny town where I live, you'll get regularly racing pigeons in the flock there, because they come down in a race, they see the flock, oh, there's food, there's other birds, there's going to be food. So adding, if they don't fly away again and nobody picks them up, they're adding to the flock numbers as well. So, there's so much going on. And I do feel that we could control, but let's just say we could wave a magic wand and control the whole population of pigeons all over the country now. If you don't stop the racing birds coming in and landing, they're just going to, it's just going to restart. So, and they're not, on any form of contraception, and they're not roosting anywhere. They're just going to join the flocks, and the flock's going to get bigger again. So it's a massive problem. It's a really big problem. So yeah, it's really good to see what they are trialing out there. And hopefully we can, you know, from what they're doing, we can convince the councils out here that we need to do a similar thing. But that's kind of what I'm trying to do is set up this year. I set up the National Pigeon Advocacy Association. And the hope of that is to just, so it's not just me and Little Green Pigeon, so that I'm more accountable because it's a group of people, but also just to give a bit more clout. So if councils and governments can hear that word association and know there are hundreds of people behind it, they'll hopefully take it a little bit more seriously, and maybe we can make some change then. That's the idea.
Actually, I have a question about that, because I also know you're doing a lot of public speaking. You're really advocating for pigeons. That's what Adele mentioned, you're doing the world's first pigeon conference. Can you tell us how important it is to advocate and to be loud about that topic? And like, it counts for everybody when you're advocating for, you know, veganism or cows, or it doesn't have to be pigeon, but why is it so important to be so loud about it?
Thank you. Yeah, it's really important because you are right. I've done a lot of public speaking in the last 3 years, and I still, when I go and talk, even at a vegan event, you can guarantee that at least 70% of the audience won't know why we need to advocate for pigeons. They won't know that they're domestic. They won't know anything about pigeon racing. They just don't know, because it's so well hidden. Because the rhetoric of them is they're dirty birds, they're disease ridden, and we need to get rid of them. Or with the racing industry, they're pet birds that are loved, and that's what's bandied about. If you look at horse racing or greyhound racing, which luckily we're just about to ban in Wales, which is great news, you can see the thanks to the work that people are doing in those industries now. We can see how horrible that is for horses, and how terrible the conditions are, and what happens to the horses, because we've shone a light on that. With pigeons, it's very, very difficult to do, because if you're walking down the street and you see 100 pigeons go over your head, your natural instinct is to look up and think they're having a great time because they love to fly. Yeah, but they're not. They're having a terrible time, because actually what they're doing is literally racing for their life. They're just trying to get home. They use something called widowing with pigeon racing, where because they know they mate for life, and because they co-parent, so both parents will, I know this is really sad, I can see your face, I'm so sorry, Alex, it's really miserable. They will both produce crop milk, and that's a hormone milk, the same as with people, which is rare in birds. There's only two birds, pigeons and penguins, that do it. Both parents produce a crop milk, so they co-parent, they share sitting on the eggs, they share feeding the babies. They're really good parents. So what pigeon fanciers do is take advantage of that. They let them fall in love, they let them breed, they let them have babies, and then they take one of those birds away, because they know there's then more of an emotional pull, as well as a necessary pull to get home for food, for that bird to fly home. So that's why they do it. It's called widowhood, and it's horrendously cruel. It's so cruel. And having a sanctuary with so many birds, I can tell you, and anyone that's looked after more than like 4 or 5 pigeons, they would tell you the same. Once they're partnered up, if that bird, let's say I've got 2 birds and one of them, needs worming, and I take the hen away from the cock in their aviary, and they're, you know, they're all having a great time, it's where they live, they're fine. You take that bird away just to give them a worming tablet, that other hen, that cockbird, is going to go absolutely mental, calling, really distressed, looking for their partner. They absolutely adore each other. And you know, you put the hen back in, and they fuss them, and they groom them, and they show off to them constantly. Like, they're really good partners, male pigeons. They're constantly trying to keep their women happy. They're great. Men could learn from them. So, and I mean, and some women could as well. So pigeon fanciers use that to their advantage. So pigeon racing is not just exploitative by the very nature that they've been bred just to create money, but it's exploitative of their very nature as well, of their gentle nature and the fact that they love each other so much.
That's really awful.
It's absolutely horrendous, isn't it? It's awful. And it's just so well hidden. It's so well hidden. So yeah, that's part of the reason I go out and talk about it, because you can guarantee if you, and in the way I talk about it, I do really kind of humanize the birds and get people invested in how lovely they are, because they are, you know, I'm not making anything up. They are incredible, really beautiful little birds and little souls. They're so full of love. And if you can get people interested in that, and then you break that news that actually this is how they're exploited, it's horrible. It does. You know, I have people in tears regularly when I'm doing talks, But what they will do is they will go away and they will tell that story to someone else. And that's why it's really important that it's told as a story, because if you can give somebody that, they're not going to forget it. They're going to go away and they're going to talk to somebody else and somebody else. And it's just these little whispers going around. But I also think that there's a second part to that, which is people, as you know, are losing their connection with nature all over the world. Pigeons are in the towns and cities. They're already there. And sometimes they are the only bird that people are going to see because they're disconnected from nature. If you can get those people to see those pigeons as the individuals that they are by watching their body language, learning that they love each other so much and that they have partners and that they both look after their babies, that's the key to veganism as well. Because most people that are living in towns and cities aren't even seeing blue tits, they're not seeing blackbirds, they're not seeing magpies and crows, they're not seeing anything, they're just seeing concrete. But these little grey birds that are running around, if you can show them that animal and then explain to them that all animals are like that, that again is another way you can make more compassionate. So if you can have compassion for a pigeon, you can have compassion for any animal, because most people hate them. So yeah. Again, that's another thing I do, is I go out and do these talks at non-vegan events. And as you said at the start, in our sanctuary shop and at festivals, and you can just get that connection with people. And then hopefully they make the connection then to farmed animals and to chickens.
Yeah.
They're similar.
And that's one thing that we've tried to normalize as well, is talking about community animals, and perhaps we should all be including and advocating for pigeons being a part of that. So the animals that live in urban environments especially, but also rural environments around us, they're not wild, they are domesticated, the cats, the dogs, the pigeons, viewing them more as like part of the community. As you said, the only kind of maybe birds that we see, we don't see any other like wild felines who walk out our door. Like, it's pretty unique thing, but they live in the community around us, and we can't change that. And there is therefore a reason for us to take care of them and perhaps view them more as community animals, regardless of their species. And you made some points around ethics earlier, and also advocating for them and how important it is. One thing that I've heard from even people who work around veganism and animal rights is a little bit of like shock when I talk about the egg replacement that we do in sanctuary, but also the groups that do it on the street. I've heard people say, like, isn't that cruel? Like, don't they feel that you're taking the eggs away? Like, what if the eggs are fertilized? And these are from people who do care about and advocate for animals already. So could you talk a little bit about that, what the realities are, what they experience, and how to kind of mitigate any ethical problems around that?
Yeah, sure. The reality is, and the simple answer to that is, they generally do notice you're taking their eggs. So if we can be black and white about it, is it ethical? Is it cruel? No, it's not ethical. And yes, it probably is cruel, because they generally notice when you're messing with the eggs. They don't always notice that egg that you're putting back in is plastic. Some of them do. I have had, particularly the hens, will be so upset and so aggressive that they won't eat properly. It's horrible. But this is one of those situations where we've created this mess. They wouldn't even, you know, there would be no such breed as a feral pigeon. There'd be no such species if we hadn't done that. And if we allow them to breed and breed and breed, they will suffer so much more than if we... So it's horrible, isn't it? Because they can't give us consent. And if they could consent, they would certainly say, leave my eggs alone. And that's what they are saying. They're just not saying that in our language. But unfortunately, the situation we're in with them now is they're not really any choice, and that there's not really any other way of doing it. I know we were talking about the contraception on the food, but as you say, that's not 100% perfect. We still need to take the eggs away, really. So yeah, it's not easy. And I can tell you, it having to do that basically on a daily basis, when you've got a big flock, it does break your heart a little bit every single time, especially when some of these are birds that I used to have about 7 hens that were so good and so maternal that if we had a baby brought in, a baby pigeon that had fallen out of a nest, they would not notice. You could just take an egg out, replace them with a baby, and they'd go, oh, my egg's hatched, great, and they'll just care for that baby. And these are really intelligent birds. But, you know, obviously it's different, you know, with mammals that they're actually physically giving birth. Obviously, they're going to notice, because I haven't actually given birth. But with an egg, of course, they don't. So you know, they're just suddenly sitting on an egg and then 2 minutes later they're sitting on a baby, they just kind of assume that that egg has hatched and they'll look after the baby. And, you know, and we're talking about tiny babies or actually up to about a week. I've had success even with week-old babies. With some of the hens I had, they're so maternal that they'll just start feeding straight away and they're all excited. Oh, the baby's here. So you can see that bond, which just then makes the taking the eggs away even worse. It's absolutely horrendous.
Yeah, that's so lovely.
Yeah, it's something called candling is what you do. So in the old days, you'd use a candle. Now you just use a bright torch. You can put a torch under an egg and then you can see what is in that egg. So you can see if it's fertile or not. Generally, you get kind of used to seeing it. And you can also see if there's a heartbeat. And that was always the one for me. When it's a collection of cells, you just see sort of a little grey dot. I never have really had that much guilt taking that away. I'm like, well, I'll replace it with a plastic egg. Because sometimes they do lay eggs that are infertile. Sometimes they lay eggs and they crack open and there's not a baby in there. Sometimes if you accidentally miss an egg, which does happen in big sanctuaries, they're very, very good at hiding their eggs. You see a baby and the next day that baby's died. You know, sometimes, like anything, you know, you can't guarantee that all of the chicks that are born are going to be sort of, they're going to grow properly. So there's always variance, but generally speaking, yeah, you take the eggs away when there's not an actual baby in there. It's the only way to say it. That's the way I dealt with that ethically. And also the knowledge, like with any sanctuary, if you allow the birds in your sanctuary to breed, you can't, well, first of all, you're not a sanctuary anymore. I don't know what you are, but you're not a sanctuary. And second of all, you can't help any other birds. It's that simple. Because if I can only fit 10 in and you know, I've got 8 birds and one of them has a batch of 2 babies, then we're full. And then the next bird that comes in, you know, what do you do? So you just have to do it. And it's not very nice. And as I say, if we're looking at just straight down the line, black and white, is it ethical? Probably not. You're taking away another animal's babies. I don't have the right to do that anymore, that you have the right to control human population in the same way. But this is where we are, and there's no other way. And I'm sure you've had these conversations that could extend as far as, should we be neutering, you know, wild animals? We're taking away their reproductive rights, and we have no right to do that. But for the, you know, for their health and safety and the quality of their life, these are, you know, what we have to do. We're the problem. And yeah, that is the only solution.
You're absolutely right. I think we've talked about this a little bit before as well. And if we are looking at it in a, like an ideal lens, we can say, no, we are doing unconsensual things. We talk about this with spay and neuter. And I know that's why there has been some opposition to things like spay and neuter. But what you also said there is, unfortunately, it's necessary. Unfortunately, this is the position that we're currently in. And just as you said before, a lot of people, if they walk down the street and they see an injured animal, they're not going to stop and ask for their consent. They're going to help them because they view them as being in distress and we don't want to turn our empathy off. The difference is when you take a step back and not just think, okay, I'm going to rescue them and then fix them and then put them back. You think about the broader picture. You think about the sheer number of animals and how often they reproduce, like you illustrated just now, and realize that's not practical. And that's when we say, okay, how can I practically help? Perhaps egg replacing, perhaps preventing reproduction in sanctuary. And that also leads us to spay and neuter. So it's not great. And we talk about this with like spay aborts as well and euthanasia. It's the same justification. We don't have their consent, but we're trying to prevent more suffering. And unfortunately, currently, this is the best option we have. And unfortunately, it's necessary.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, you brought up euthanasia there as well. I've got into all sorts of trouble in the past and I still do with my views on that. I was on the BBC radio a few weeks ago and I got so much hate for saying this, but the reality is if you have an injured bird brought into your sanctuary and you have limited funds, limited space, and no one else will assist you, and that bird is injured and you can't help that bird, then euthanasia is a treatment option because the suffering is horrendous and you can, you know, you can give them a peaceful end. And I think I have come across sanctuary owners that just won't do that. And that I just find that incredibly selfish. And I do get into hot water for saying that. But I think if those are the realities of caring for animals, whether they be unwanted domestic animals like pigeons, dogs, cats, or out of control domestic animals like the cats that you look after, or whether they're wild animals, sometimes you just have to make that decision. And for that particular bird, of course, in an ideal world, we would be doing orthopedic surgery to fix a broken leg. We'd be giving them a palace of an aviary to live in, but that's not the real world. And the real world is there's everyday suffering for these birds and for all animals, but particularly for these pigeons that we're seeing. Some of them are in such a desperately bad state that actually the kindest and most ethical thing to do is to put them to sleep on arrival, basically. Yeah, so it's a messed up world, and all we can do is the best. And I think as long as we're ethically led and we're doing everything to try and help them, then we're doing it right.
So I have a question, Sue. For people who don't have a lot of knowledge about pigeons, but they live in cities, what are some individual action they can take? Even if they see an injured pigeon, what are some things they can do?
That's a really good question. So the first thing to say is, remember that you are very, very, very unlikely to catch a disease from a pigeon. There is a horrible rhetoric that they are disease carrying. It's not. It's an old wives' tale. They can carry salmonella. They can carry worms. They can carry, sort of lice and all sorts. And they do regularly. But they're not necessarily zoonotic diseases. They are bird-to-bird diseases. And secondly, unless you're going to really get them close to your face or, sort of lick them, you're very unlikely to get ill from a pigeon, not in a first aid situation. Sanctuary owners do sometimes get something called pigeon keeper's lung, and so do people that keep pigeons as pets. And that's because they're breathing in. The birds are quite dandery. They give off quite a lot of almost powder when their feathers are growing. And if you inhale that all the time, then you can get a lung condition from that. And it's not very nice. And I do know a few sanctuary owners who've got that, and it's horrible. But these are people that have looked after pigeons in and out of sheds for years, years and years and years. You're going to help a pigeon on the street, you are not going to catch, as long as you use your basic hygiene and wash your hands and don't eat a sandwich while you do it, you're going to be fine. So that's the first thing to remember. Just be realistic about it. Like, that's the first thing to remember. And the second thing is, they can't hurt you. They can nip you with their beaks. It doesn't hurt. They're not going to hurt you. They can't. And if they're injured, they're not going to fly at you. They're not going to try and gouge your eye out. These are not aggressive birds. They're scared animals, but they're not aggressive. So they're not going to hurt you. Catching a pigeon is a real skill. I've got a really bad back. Me trying to catch a pigeon on the street, it's hilarious and not very nice for the pigeon. So I generally don't do it. I generally try and get someone else to help me because I'm quite old and my back's really knackered. But there are easy ways even for people like me to do it. And that is use a towel, use a coat, use a t-shirt, use a jumper, whatever you've got. And if you can kind of corner that bird and then throw something light like that over them, once that material lands on that bird, they are very unlikely to try and fly and you can just grab them. The chances are, if you do grab them, you're not going to injure them unless you land on them. And that would just be accidents anyway. But you're not going to hurt them. And that's the main thing, that when I have people on the phone with me, they're like, I'm going to hurt them. And I'm like, right, that pigeon's got a broken wing, a broken leg. It's got canker. That pigeon is going to die. You are going to do a lot more harm leaving them to suffer than you are trying to catch them. So throw your coat over them, scoop them up. Don't worry about being too rough. You are very unlikely to make the situation worse like that. Once you've got them contained in a coat, in a box, then start making phone calls and try and find local rehabilitation centres. One of the things that I'm trying to do is to get a network of people that look after pigeons all the way around the UK, so that with a main number, so that if somebody comes across a bird like that, they can phone and they can get some help. Because it is very difficult to try and find people that will look after pigeons. You can find people that will look after the garden birds that we mentioned earlier. Loads of people. There's thousands of people doing that. But trying to get hold of somebody that's specifically looking after a pigeon, because they're so different, it is a little bit more difficult. And again, I think that is a barrier to care, because people see a pigeon and they think, oh, I could pick her up, but then I'll be lumbered with her. What will I do?
Yeah.
And that I can understand that way of thinking. It's the same as if you see a stray dog in this country or a stray cat, you think, well, I could put that dog in my car, but then if I can't get that dog anywhere, I can't take her back. I live in a flat, or I rent, or I've already got dogs. I get it. I do get why people leave them there. But honestly, even if worst case scenario, all you can do is pick up that injured pigeon, put them in a box and take them to a veterinary practice, and that veterinary practice euthanizes the bird, at least you prevent their suffering. So I think that's the baseline, is to say, look, if you can prevent suffering, then that's the best thing in a bad situation. The best thing in a great situation is you capture that bird, you find a local rehabber, and they get the care they need. And that's what we want. But you're right, it's just that everybody can help. And it always gets left to, the people like you and I, and the thousands of other versions of you and I all over the world, hundreds and millions of us there are now, I know that, but it's still only a small percentage of the population that actually do the work. But everybody can be an advocate for these birds. Everybody, it's so easy. So yeah, that's what I'd say is just try. Don't leave it to someone else, because by the time someone else finds them, it might be too late.
Thank you so much, Sue. We need to take a quick break, but we'll be back in a few minutes.
You know the expression, cats have nine lives. Well, what if you can give them one more? The Give Them 10 movement is on a mission to help give cats an extra life. How? With Spay and Neuter. Spaying or neutering your cat helps them live a longer, healthier life. And it helps control free-roaming cat populations too. Learn more about the benefits of spay and neuter and meet Scooter, the neutered cat, at givethem10.org. That's givethem10.org.
Let's talk pets.
Let's talk pets.
On Pet Life Radio.
Pet Life Radio.
PetLifeRadio.com.
And we're back with Sue, who is giving us so much practical information about pigeons. We're so happy to have her on the podcast. And we have time for our last question, and it's about the world's first pigeon conference. Sue, tell us more about this. This is so exciting.
It's very exciting. It's very, very, very exciting. It was an idea that I had, I think it was the end of last year. I was like, what we need is we need to educate a little bit, like we were just saying, we need to educate more and more people about this. And then somebody else that I believe we all know, Shakira, unbeknownst to me, had just sort of got into, she rescues loads of animals and does loads of incredible work, but had also just started falling in love with pigeons, was like, people need to know more about this. So it just ended up, I happened to be on the phone to her one day about a pigeon. And I said, you know, I've been thinking what we really need is. And she said, I was thinking the same thing. So that's where this conference came from. So we started working on it at the start of the year, and we've now got a date and a venue. And it's been quite a lot of hard work getting there because, as you rightly said, nobody else has done it yet. It's the first pigeon advocacy conferences. There are many, many, many conferences for pigeons all over the world, and they are all for the cruelty towards pigeons, because they're either fancy pigeon, where pigeons are bought and sold for fancy, sort of big floofy ones, pet pigeons, or they're for pigeon racing. So, but this is the first one that's actually for the education of people, for helping them, which is why we're so excited about it. So it's the 20th of September, and it's at a conference centre in Staffordshire, which is in England, in the UK. Our whole aim for this conference is education. It's going to be a lot of fun as well. We know there's going to be a lot of fun, but we want to educate. So we've got some incredible speakers lined up, some veterinary surgeons that deal specifically with wildlife and pigeons. Richard Saunders is one of them, who I'm very excited. Anissa Malik, who's an RVN, so that's a registered veterinary nurse in this country, who again deals with specifically birds. She just had a paper published, and she writes for the Veterinary Times and things like that. She's brilliant. She's going to come and speak to us. There's some people that we're still waiting to talk to confer, so I can't mention them, but we've got some really good people from abroad coming as well. We've got Kevin Newell, who runs Humane Wildlife Solutions. He's going to come and talk to everybody about netting and the law and what we can do as individuals to help if we see. And that covers any animal. You know, he deals with all wildlife, but he just loves pigeons, so he wants to come and do this for us. But he helps with trapped seagulls and trapped pigeons and all sorts in that horrible netting that they put on buildings. So he's going to come and talk about that. I'm going to do a bit of a talk about pigeon racing and what we can do to try and get a ban in place. We've got some entertainment on the evening, a vegan singer. We've got a vegan comedian. Got a little bit of that lighthearted as well. Because, I mean, those are all quite heavy subjects. We're having a workshop where we're talking about euthanasia and you know, how we can all deal with that. And we're also having a couple of networking sessions, one in the afternoon and one in the evening, because there are people coming from all over the world. When we first talked about this, I thought we'd get 50 people from, I don't know, a few places in maybe England. But now we've had people from all over the world say they wanted to come to this, which has been amazing. So we're going to do a networking session. Not quite sure how it's going to work yet. It, at the moment it's looking like it's going to be chaotic, but that's fine. I can deal with chaos. I think it's going to be basically me saying to somebody, who do you want to meet? And then going, I want to meet that person and move on and introducing. But I just want people to be able to feel that they can chat to each other, learn from each other's experience. We've got quite a few big animal charities coming now, like Animal Aid, Freedom for Animals. There's quite a few people coming from those sort of organisations as well. So they can help and they can get involved. We've been sponsored by Veganism in Education, who've been absolutely amazing. And they gave us £2,000 towards the conference, which means that that's paid for the venue completely.
Oh my God.
Which means, yeah, Michelle St. John is absolutely incredible. She does amazing things for all animals and for veganism. But she loves pigeons. So she came forward and said, look, we'd like to give you the money for the venue, which means that the tickets, instead of being £100 a ticket, which is a lot of money to rehabbers, you know, when you're trying to look after all these birds, you want to put your money to the birds, not to, you know, even though it's educational, but you don't want to spend it on a conference. It means we've been able to greatly reduce the ticket cost. So all the tickets include food for the whole day. There's cheap accommodation on site. So we were just so pleased that not only are we able to hopefully educate a lot of people in one place, but we can also offer them some support. They can join the NPAA, the National Association, while they're there, and they can also learn a little bit about another thing I've got with my other hat on, which is called Harper's Fund, which is a 10-year project that I'm heading up, which is to get funds in, government funds in, and funds from businesses that we can redistribute the wealth then to rehabbers, not just sanctuaries, but people in their own homes. So they join our list, so we can phone them if we need help, I don't know, in a certain city, and then they can then ask for money and they'll get that money straight away. They don't have to fill in any forms. It's really easy for people to say, look, I've got this injured pigeon. She needs to go to the vets. Can you pay the vet bill? They can just phone and we'll say, yeah, we'll cover the vet bill. And we'll just send some money to the vets. So it's all covered, because we need to take the financial pressure away from rehabbers. It's going to be a very long-term project. I'm banging my head against the wall at the moment trying to get funding, but I will get there. I'm very determined. So it's a 10-year project, but we will get there. And that's another reason for this conference, is to try and get those people in one place, in one room, so we can work all this out, how this is going to look, and that people know that they're not on their own. Because as you know, working veganism can be lonely if you haven't got a supportive group around you, and sanctuary work can be extremely lonely. And I just really believe in people. I believe that people are inherently good. They're just not all in the same place that we are yet, but we'll get them there. And if we can just support people, because I am aware that a lot of people, I'd say probably 50% of people that look after pigeons are not vegan. They're not quite there yet. So we need to nurture them, and we need to show them that we're kind, and we need to help them. And then not only will they help the birds, but we can help them as well. And it's just a great big lovely pigeon circle then. So that's the conference.
That's so exciting. And that's so much work to put it all together as well. And I mean, as you said, like, networks are everything. People to learn from, people to ask for help or advice. We would really benefit from something like that in Greece. I mean, I think currently there really aren't any solutions for pigeons in Greece. Like, there are a lot of groups who work on urban animals like dogs and cats, but nobody does anything for pigeons. I don't know anybody who will catch them or help them. And I think a huge barrier, even to myself, is what to do with them after. There's no sanctuary they can go to. There's one wildlife rehabilitation center that I've personally volunteered in to investigate the circumstances that pigeons receive care under, because we've heard a lot of bad things and we're not sure that they actually get the care that they need. There's been a lot of suspicion that they just get euthanized. And I think a lot of vets also wouldn't accept pigeons into the clinic, and people wouldn't be able to pay for their care. So a lot of times people just leave them on the street. They don't even try simple stuff like de-stringing, just because of, you know, what to do with them after. The wildlife center doesn't care about them. What's the solution? So that's a big part of it, is just having some kind of like support network, availability of resources, things like that. So that's amazing that you've done all of that. I can't wait to see it come to fruition.
Thank you. Yeah, it's hard work, but totally worth it. And I think hopefully we'll make a difference. And it's interesting. I'm really saddened to hear that about Greece. And I can completely empathize, because, yeah, like you say, it's better here, but it's still not perfect. But we're already talking about if we can get this up and running and get a model for this. We're already talking with quite a big sanctuary in America about almost franchise is the wrong word, because franchise implies that it would be a financial transaction. It wouldn't be that. But almost if we can set up this model here and then set it up in one of the states in America, see how that runs, then that's maybe a model that we can then take on and, you know, globally. You know, you've got to think big. Why think small? You can think big. So, yeah. So maybe one day we get Harper's Fund working in Greece as well.
It's amazing, Sue. You're giving us a talk of hope, and that's really nice in today's world. Where can people find you for that conference, to follow your adventure with the pigeon? Where can they find you?
Thank you. They can find the conference on Instagram. We've got Instagram pages because everyone does, don't they? So UK Pigeon Conference. If you can't find that, you can find it through Little Green Pigeon. And I am Little Green Pigeon on all the socials. You can go to the National Pigeon Advocacy Association. So that's www.nationalpigeonadvocacyassociation.co.uk. It is a tongue twister. I understand that that's a long word for the association. I did it like that just to irritate the bad people that look after pigeons in this country, because it's almost a similar name to their association. So I did that just to piss them off. That's why I called it that. Because there's a National Pigeon Association and they're horrible to pigeons. So we just slipped in the word advocacy. So yeah, but basically if you Google Little Green Pigeon or Susan Joyce, it'll come up on Google. So yeah.
Perfect. Thank you so much for joining us, Sue. We really appreciate it.
Thank you. I really appreciate the opportunity to talk about it. Thank you so much. And thank you for loving pigeons.
Yay. And thank you to all of our listeners. Thank you so much for joining us on this adventure. We're so excited about it and would love to hear about what you have to say about pigeon. Have you ever rescued a pigeon? What are your struggles about it? And maybe we can answer it in the next episode. So send us a DM on either Saving Lives with Two A's or Travel Animal Rescue on Instagram. See you all at our next episode. And in the meantime, stay out of trouble and keep trapping to save the streets one animal at a time.
Let's Talk Pets every week on demand, only on PetLifeRadio.com.